That's good, huh? Well, good morning. I am excited about sharing this morning. I think I say this every week, but boy, I look forward to being together. It really is a wonderful thing. And as we've been walking through this week in our God's Facebook time, spending time putting our face in His book, not just to get through a checklist, but really to have a face-to-face encounter with the living God. This week, we got to finish up Job. I think we read through Galatians. We were at 1 Corinthians. And I wanted to dive into 1 Corinthians this morning. And I want to give you a little background about Corinth and the Corinthian people, so that you begin to understand the context in which Paul was sharing or writing this letter to the church in Corinth. He wrote the letter while he was in Ephesus, and they think that the city of Corinth was about 400,000 people. And a church was birthed in this place, and the city is about 40 miles west of Athens, Greece. So you can get a picture, and it's a port city, and it had a number of ports there, but there were two main ports that the commerce of the world would flow through. And as you could imagine Corinth, you would see Greeks, Jews, you'd see Italians, you would see sailors and merchants and adventurers. You'd see all kinds of walks of life from the entire Roman Empire that would be wandering through 400,000 different cultures put together in this port city. It was a hub of culture, it was a hub of fashion, and it was the hub of politics. There was a lot of things happening and going on. Corinth, in the Roman Empire, was known as Sin City. I mean, it was a place where it was the center of darkness. If you can imagine the depravities of each of these cultures that were there. And they didn't just have a sense of tolerance. It was tolerance with a sense of embracing all of the depravities of each culture and everything that they brought. And everything was okay. What works for you, it's okay for you, and what works for me is okay. And there wasn't just an acceptance of that, there was really an embracing of that, which allowed for sin and wickedness really to flourish. I think where we're at in our culture today, these are things that I think we need to pay attention to. The heart of the city was a temple, and it was an incredible temple. It was a beautiful temple built to the goddess Aphrodite, where they had 1,000 priestesses that would serve that temple. And these priestesses, their religion was sex. That's what they were there for. So you can imagine, you know, merchants and sailors and people coming to the city. They were there, and they wanted to go to that temple. It was known throughout the empire. There's a phrase called that Romans coined, and it's called to Corinthianize. To Corinthianize meant this, that you went to the very edge. You went to the farthest most edge of sin. And that's what they would say in the Roman Empire. I mean, if you went to the farthest edge of sin that you could go, you were Corinthianized. And I think that's why Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 2, he said this, "For I am determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and Him crucified." He was not going to be Corinthianized. Paul was dead set. He was determined. That wasn't going to happen. And so he wrote the letter to the Corinthians to underline the absolute lordship of Christ. Jesus is the solution to all of your problems that you're facing. In fact, he would say, Jesus is, he's bigger. With an ER. He's bigger. And it's with this setting that I'd like us to look this morning. We're going to look at the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. And I really wrestled with this week and felt like this is what we're supposed to speak on. And it wasn't until late Friday night where I felt like it started. I was like, wow. So I'm excited to share with you this morning about the love chapter. It's the most poetic of Paul's writings. And you know, I've had the privilege to do a whole lot of weddings. And that's one of the greatest privileges, I think, is being a part of that celebration. And to watch couples come together and to watch as families begin to grow and to celebrate that. And it's amazing when I meet with couples. I mean, almost every time they will say they want something out of the love chapter. Why? Because it's sweet. It's sentimental. And one of the weddings that I had the privilege to be a part of here was right at the very beginning. I remember this sweet, sweet, sweet woman come up to me with her finger in my face when I first came. And she said, I want you to know, I'm contending for my marriage. And she hadn't seen her husband in years. And it's a picture to me that God is bigger. Bill and Patty, would you come and share just a little bit your story? We welcome Bill and Patty. Now let's really welcome Bill and Patty.
A lot of you know our story. Some of you don't. We had been married for 30 years when it all fell apart. Bill decided to leave, and he filed for divorce. I did not see that coming. I was devastated. I was hurt. I was angry. I was depressed, and I was suicidal. And then I fell on my face before the Lord and said, God, I know you're the God of 1,000 second chances. I want a second chance at this marriage. Teach me to be a godly wife and restore this marriage. And I also remember saying, Lord, I know I need to forgive him. I can't do that without you, without your heart, without you in me. And I began on a journey where the Lord worked with me. Ouch. Revealed to me my pride and arrogance and judgmental attitude, self-righteousness. And the root of that was deep insecurity, not knowing who I was in Christ, how much I was loved, and that I had a purpose all by myself, aside from being a wife, a mother, a sister, a daughter, a grandma, that I'm okay being me, being Patty. And when I found who I was in Christ and accepted that love and that forgiveness, and I learned to forgive myself, things started turning around. So I prayed for Bill daily. I vacillated back and forth because of what was going on around me, the circumstances, the things I heard, and yet I knew in my knower, I knew, and I got confirmation after confirmation that God would restore it. I knew that. People thought I was crazy, but then they sometimes think Christians are. So anyway, I prayed for him and prayed for him. And I hadn't seen him in 4 years. Ran into him at one of our kids' get-togethers on Christmas Eve. And we were both very comfortable. And I was happy about that because we have 5 children and 11 grandchildren. So that went well. We visited that Christmas Eve. Bill called me January 10th. On January 13th, he came and fixed the light switch in my bathroom that I'd mentioned on Christmas Eve. He proposed to me on the 21st of January, and we were married on the 26th. That is an impossibility with man. Our family could not believe it because they thought we would never be together again. And God gets the glory. I also wanted to make a point. I remember John Young had a message, and he said, you have hopes and dreams and desires in your heart. Are you willing to lay them down before the Lord and give them back to him? And that really hit me, and I did that. And I remember giving it back to the Lord. And I remember finding myself in this beautiful place where I said, Lord, even if Bill and I are not restored, I will be okay. I just want you to bless him and to reveal your love to him. I can go on without him, but Jesus, I can't make a day without you. And that was a big deal for me. Then I really knew who I was in him and how much he loved me. So God has restored this wonderful man to me, and he is an inspiration. I admire him. He makes me laugh. And God is faithful. Don't ever give up. Don't ever give up on loved ones. And when it looks ugly, just realize they're working on their testimony.
This is a godly wife. There's a very good chance I can't finish. But if that happens, if I have to walk away, realize that the emotion I feel for her is the deepest thing outside of my emotion for the Lord. So I wrote down a few things at Dan's request. I'll try to get through this. Talking here, but I'll do the best I can. I was asked to write a few words. I got pen and paper. I have a lot to say about Patty, so I thought I needed quite a bit. But when she walked in and told me I had 2 minutes, it kind of took the wind out of my sails. But I have this so I don't get off on rabbit trails, because you just don't know how much I could say about her and what I feel and how much regret that I tore her life apart by being selfish, arrogant, and full of myself. It was all about me. I'm down 3/4 of the page already. I'm off track. But anyway, to give you a little history leading up to our getting back together. I dropped out of school at 16 and started a family. I failed at that marriage of 13 years just because of the youth and not having the tools to make it work. So I left Ohio with my 3 kids, came to the Northwest. Met Patty very shortly after that. At a dance, and we quickly stole each other's hearts. It was just meant to be. She had 2 kids, I had 3. We were both very family oriented, and it was just a perfect fit. How something starting out so wonderful can go so bad, it's life. And if we don't work at it, we stumble. I was too stubborn to get counseling. She begged me to go to counseling. Being the stubborn, arrogant, self-absorbed man that I was, there was no way I was going to do that. Boy. Anyway, I'm sorry, Dan. It's going to be more than 2 minutes. I would not listen to anyone. I would not. It was going to be my way or the highway, and that's what I did, you know, out of fight, flight, or fear, I chose flight. I walked away from my family, from her, from everything. I wanted to travel. I wanted to live down south in the winter, live up here in the summer. I tried those things, bought a home in Arizona, wasn't happy. Moved to Texas and bought a home, wasn't happy. I was missing something, and I didn't know what it was, but I had started going to a Baptist church and was having a slow walk back towards the Lord, being stubborn, took pride in being a hard nut to crack. I was my own man. No one was going to tell me what to do. No one was going to control me in any way. I was going to do just as Bill wanted. So arrogant, so full of myself. Really, I'm not a man of many words, but when I'm in an arrogant state, I can be nothing like you folks have seen me in the last 4 years. I'm not proud of that. It wrecked our life. It wrecked our family's life. Guys, don't meet your wife halfway. When she needs it, when it's your turn to give, give as close to 100% as you can. Run back to her. Hold her in your arms, even if she's upset. And if she's too upset to let you hold her, speak to her. Let her know what you feel, what you think. Let her know she is the most important person on this earth to you. Your relationship with God should be number one. Because if you don't look up, there's no chance of you looking to her and her filling your needs. Because no one can fill your needs. The Lord lets us accomplish what we accomplish in life if we make the right choices. But we can sure ruin our lives and other people's lives if we don't open ourselves up, be vulnerable, and trust. It is so hard to trust another human being. But I trust this lady. I love this lady with all my heart. I could go from A to Z and write down every word of love and affection on these sheets of paper. And with the volume of that, in some people's eyes, that would show what I feel. But for me to stand up here with tears streaming down my face, believe me, have faith in God. He can do anything. My family was totally shocked because I had said, no way on the face of this earth would we ever be back together. But it was out of my control, because back in January of 2007, I started having dreams of Patty. And that was upsetting to me. Actually, I got kind of aggravated with God because I didn't know what was going on. But I was so emotionally distraught, so against everything, that I couldn't feel anything. I didn't even feel for my grandkids and my children like a normal person should feel, because I had just shut down. I contemplated suicide. Only the thought, because that scared me so bad that I couldn't do that to my family. But it also shocked me to let me know how far I had sunk. I think you understand how much I love her, how much God can do. He can do the impossible. Don't be foolish and ask for things. Garth Brooks' song, Thank God for Unanswered Prayers, is such a beautiful song that, and I thank him very much for not answering a lot of my prayers, but for answering hers. Share one thing with you. I was getting ready to fix the light switch. And I'd always worked electricity hot, never turned it off. And as she does, she always gives me advice on how to do things. So she came in the bathroom as I was ready to do the work, and she said, "Have you turned off the electricity?" And I said, "No, honey." And she said, "Well, Bill, you know you should." I said, "Well, honey, maybe we should try mouth to mouth in case I do get shocked to make sure that you can save me." So it embarrassed her. She fled the bathroom and left me alone. So please trust in the Lord. Please believe that he can restore broken relationships, whether it's with your children, whether it's with a friend, no matter what. if we trust, if we believe, only to the extent that we trust him will we ever realize just who and how much he is to us. I have to do this again, and boy, it's probably going to be so much different next. Stick around.
Bless you. Thank you. No, it's good. No, it's good. Isn't that good? You know, Patty said, the thing that I think was important in her prayer is, God, let me be a godly wife again. And I remember Bill saying one time that he had only one feeling for Patty during those 4 years where they didn't see each other. He said, I felt sorry that she ever thought there was ever hope. What's impossible with man is possible with God, and God is bigger. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. As we dive into the love chapter here, I want to say this. No Corinthian, when they read this letter and they read the love chapter, thought, oh, that's lovely. That gives me goosebumps. That's so poetic, Paul. It was challenging. It was speaking to them right where they were at. There are three words in the Greek that are translated into the word, the one word that we have is love. And to a Greek, in understanding what Paul was writing, I think it's important just to highlight this. Eros is a passion or lust. And this was the kind of love that the Corinthians had been immersed in the city of Corinth. They understood Eros love. But this is not the love that Paul is referring to in 1 Corinthians 13. Then there's a love that's called phileo love. We get the word Philadelphia from phileo. Phileo is a noble love. It's a love for a brother. It's honorable. But this is not the love that Paul was writing about either. The love that Paul was talking about was agape love. And agape love is, it's a divine love. It's about a deeper love. It's about something more than eros. It's something more than phileo. It is agape. And so it's really significant when Paul is writing this, because he's saying that love is more than an emotion. It's an action. It's the very definition of God. For God is love. If you're going to make an outline of 1 Corinthians chapter 13, you would see it's divided into three paragraphs. Paragraph 1 will put the fear of God into you. Paragraph 2 illustrates how short we fall. And paragraph 3 finally gives us some hope. There is hope in the end. But Paul first wants us to face our current state. We see in 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 3, it's the significance of love. You go to the next paragraph in verses 4 through 7, and it's the understanding of love. And then you go to the last paragraph, which is verses 8 through 13, you see the triumph of love to come. So let's look first at the significance of love, those first three verses. The Corinthians, they knew that they were special. They knew that they were spiritually gifted. But Paul is saying that there is some of you in this church that are missing the foundation. We've got to get back to the foundation. I want to catch your attention here. And so Paul paints this picture. He gives us a glimpse. And what he's doing here is he's thinking of who are the most, if you were to picture in your mind, the most spiritual, the most passionate-looking, church-going people that you can imagine. And so Paul paints this picture, and there's three pictures here in this first three verses. First picture is the picture of a passionate worshiper. If I speak in tongues of men or of angels but do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. See, the Corinthians, if you imagine the culture, and I love how the enemy is always does a counterfeit of what is God's. And so if you imagine Corinth, it's full of passion, full of pleasure. I can only imagine what the real thing looked like. Because if they were all about that in that city, God would take what was an imitation and make it real. So here they are. You can picture the experience there. You can picture people that love to worship. They love to speak in tongues, as did Paul. Worship was an event and an experience. Remember the culture, extreme emotionalism. I think you would have seen worship that was off the charts in the Corinthian church. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think when they spoke in tongues, they imagined the more indecipherable, the better. And I mean, you can just see what was going on. They'd worked themselves up into this spiritual frenzy. It was amazing. It was passionate. It was loud. And then Paul says this, I don't care if you know every language on earth, every language in heaven. Language without love is nothing more than noise. Paul's not arguing against tongues. He's not saying that worship should be devoid of all emotion. I think what he's painting is a positive picture of worship. But he's calling them back to the foundation of a life with Jesus is more than emotion, and it's more than goosebumps. He's addressing the foundation of the heart of worship, Jesus Christ. And then we go to the second verse, and he gives us a picture of the profound prophet. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. We all can be moved by a powerful prophetic pastor who's preaching, who can quote from the Greek, eros, phileo, agape, who can quote the Hebrew, Elohim, Adonai. Are you guys moved? Paul says, no love, then it's nothing. It's nothing. Can you imagine? You can have extraordinary God-given gifts and not know Jesus. That you can perform impressive, even supernatural works and really not know God. He is addressing the foundation, not just of a heart, but he's also addressing the foundation of our mind, our intellect. And then we get to the third picture, the perfect servant. And he's painting pictures of kind of the top notch. If you were to come in and go and look on the outside, well, how about this perfect servant? If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardships that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. You know, we can oftentimes get caught up into the works. We can do some really good things. We could accomplish all the Linderman projects around the globe. You think we don't need more passionate worshipers. We don't need better preachers with high intellect. What we need here is action. Less hype, more action. What do they get for this? Well, Paul imagines a churchgoer giving away everything, even their very life, for the cause of the kingdom. And if they do not know love, they gain nothing. What is Paul saying here in these first three verses is, it's absolutely necessary, love. Knowing love involves the heart, it involves the mind, and it involves the will. Paul's warning us to stop looking at our gifts to tell you how you're doing in your Christian life. Being loved by Jesus, we've said this year is a year of upgrade. And Paul is saying, I want you to look at your love, not your gifts. And this year has been about an upgrade, learning to be loved by Jesus and loving Jesus and then living that love out into our community, into our world. So this first section speaks of the significance of love. And the second section, verse 4 through 7, begin to answer the question, what is love? What is this agape? Paul gives us a glimpse, and it's not an exhaustive list by any stretch of the imagination. And it's kind of like Bill coming up with all of his papers and says, you know, I can fill all these papers up. But Paul could have done the same thing here. He's not given an exhaustive list, but he's given us enough that we can begin to understand. The understanding of love. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It's not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrong. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. What Paul is saying here is love is real. He's saying love is a force. It's a power. It's a life. It doesn't come across well in English, but if you were to look at verse 4, it would literally be translated this way. Love waits patiently. Love performs kindness. And again, in verse 7, love protects, love hopes, love trusts, love perseveres. Do you see, love is active. Love acts in these ways. And love has a life of its own. See, we often think the question is, what is love? But really what Paul's getting to here is the question, who is love? It's a much better question. Because love is a person. A person who has first loved you. That's 1 John 4:19 sums it up. And it's absolutely fundamental for us to understand this. We love because He first loved us. And I think Bill underlined that beautifully this morning. We love because He first loved us. Love is a person who's acted for you. He's done verses 4 through 7 for you. You're on the receiving end of this love. Love is first something that's done to you. Then love is something that's done in you. And then finally, it's something that's done through you. Which is why verses 1 through 3 talk about having love or not having love. It's either one or the other. Do you have love or don't you? That's the big question for Paul, and I think that's also the big question that God has. It's not about loving. How are you loving on a scale from 1 to 10? Paul's interest and God's passion is one thing. Do you have love? And there is a person called love. And His name is Jesus, and He's loved you. And what Paul is saying is, do you have love? Jesus is patient. Jesus is kind. Jesus is not easily angered. Jesus keeps no record of wrongs. Jesus does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. Jesus always protects. He always trusts. He always hopes. He always perseveres. And then we get to the third section where in 8 through 13 speak of the triumph of love to come. See, Paul's going to tell us in verses 8 through 13 that none of us have arrived yet. That verses 4 through 7, we just don't get it. We get arrogant, don't we, Bill? We miss the mark. We're all waiting for maturity. We're all waiting for that perfect love. And Paul tells us this. It's coming. It's coming. Love never fails, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I reasoned like a child, when I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we only see a reflection as in the mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. Paul wants us to understand how our present experience compares to the future. I think this is important for us because we tend to love 1 minute. Bill and Patty, when they met, I mean, it was like, this is meant to be. We love 1 minute, and then we send the next. It's not complete. It's not perfect yet. So Paul comforts us and says, one day everything's going to change. I mean, that deserves an amen or something. There is hope. What is this future that Paul is talking about? Well, if you look at verses 8 and 9, we see about the gifts. It says, and these gifts that we think that are so important, they'll completely cease. I mean, all these things we put so much attention into. All the work I do at preparing these sermons, it'll cease. So what is this future? Verse 10 says, he calls it completeness. It's the idea that everything is made whole. Right now, all things are subjected to frustration. But then, and it's coming, your body will work as it was meant to work. Your relationships will work as they were meant to work. The world will work as it was meant to work. Completeness. And you're built for it. And it's coming. There's hope. And then verse 11 describes our future as maturity. Paul says, we're like kids now. If you can imagine, even the wisest and most knowledgeable among us are like toddlers compared to our wisdom and maturity that's coming. We will grow up. This person here is going to grow up someday. But yeah, my wife is going, there might be hope. Really, one day you and I are going to grow up in every dimension. We're going to mature. We're going to be complete. And it's going to be maturity beyond our wildest dreams. There's a lot of immaturity in this guy. But Paul says it's coming. Russell, hang on. It's coming. And then verse 12. And really, here's the heart of our future. It says face to face. It's like in Exodus chapter 33, we get a glimpse of our future through Moses, who's going into the tent of meeting, and he's speaking with the Lord face to face as a man speaks to his friend. Imagine the Lord face to face as one speaking to a friend. Spending time with God's Facebook as we're doing. Someday it won't just be for a few minutes, or someday it's not just going to be for an hour. It's going to be a time where it'll never fade away. Face to face with the Lord Jesus. Everything good you've ever experienced up to this point, says now, has just been a poor reflection as in a mirror. Have you had some good time with the Lord in your Facebook? It's a poor reflection of what's coming. Our FaceTime now is nothing compared to the FaceTime that's coming. Anything good now is just a poor reflection of a face-to-face to come. Every kiss you've ever wanted, every affirmation you've ever craved, every relationship you've ever pursued, every longing that you've ever felt will be fulfilled when you're face-to-face with Jesus, and it's coming. Can you imagine being face to face with Jesus and saying this? Hey, Jesus, listen to me speak in tongues. Hey, Jesus, let me tell you about my wisdom. Hey, Jesus, I got a good preach coming. Sit down. See, our gifts today can only give a poor reflection at times. They help us see through a glass darkly. And we say to each other, perfection is coming. Maturity. It's coming. Face to face with Jesus. It's coming. But there's one thing that we can do now that defines the glory of what is coming. There's just one thing. And that's love. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these, it's love. The life to come is a world of love. And Paul says, I've seen the future. This morning, we did a glimpse of the future. And that future, it's love. Complete love, mature love, and face-to-face love. Because 1 Corinthians 13, what it is a biography. It's a biography of Jesus Christ. John wrote this of Jesus. Having loved his own who were in the world, says he loved them to the end. Do you know love? Then there's hope of love to come. And that love has a name. And it's Jesus. Worship team, would you come up? I'd like us, could we do the last song that we did on the worship list? I think that's the one. I'd like us just to stand. And what we're going to do this morning, I mean, love has a name. That name is Jesus. And let's sing this song really as a declaration this morning and really understand how much you're loved. You can't do it, but we're going to try, all right? I mean, you really can't do it. But we can try. Let's stand together.